Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, May 14th. The latest state greenhouse gas report is out, and the data points to falling short of reaching our ambitious goals. We look at what's holding us back. We pause to think about the time space we're in from a Zen and Indigenous point of view. When no thing works, what are we to do? Changing things up at Hanama Bay, we hear about a plan to allow more commercialization of the bay. What's that all about? We reintroduce you to Honolulu's official city bird in today's Manu Minute. And ever wonder what it's like to read other people's minds? We talk to an author of a young adult novel with a character who can do just that. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. 2030 and 2045 are two deadlines that are looming overhead. They're tied to Hawaii's lofty green goals to cut its greenhouse gas emissions. Here with the latest report on how well we are doing is HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, no, we've talked about this issue before. You know, you've been tracking this, but there's a new report out.
Yeah, so the Department of Health is the one who actually catalogs all of the greenhouse gas emissions for the state. And they release these reports to say, look, this is how we're doing. And there's a bit of a lag. So the most recent report is actually a snapshot of data from 2022. And they use that data to project the state's progress in reducing emissions as we get closer to that 2030 and 2045 goal, which the state has laws on the books that require us to slash emissions in half in the next 5 years and then eliminate emissions entirely by 2045. And the concerning finding of the report is that we are not on track. We are going to miss both of those targets unless we make significant changes to the status quo. And the big obstacle in our emissions is the transportation sector. It makes up just shy of half of all of the state's emissions. Laura Ka'akua is the climate manager for the Department of Transportation.
There is a lot of wonderful things happening towards reducing emissions. And even with those things, right, opening new electric vehicle public charging stations, Hawaii's been a great adopter of electric vehicles, one of the leaders in the nation in that. Some really exciting progress on renewable diesel happening here locally. All of that, we are really looking at not an increase in emissions in transportation, but really a status quo, unless we take significant actions. Unless we make a real big change, there really won't be a dramatic drop in emissions, and we won't be able to make our state climate goals.
Did they say whether, you know, the fact that we're looking at data from 2022, I mean, we'll make gains at some point or what?
Yeah, so this is an important point, right? The Department of Transportation has been doing its own analysis of the status quo, basically all the things that we're already doing with putting in EV charging stations and increases in uptake of biodiesel, for instance. And they say if we continue with those actions, which are great, we're not going to see emissions rise, but we're also not going to see the precipitous drops that we need to meet these ambitious goals. So the department has been trying to release and develop a new strategy that includes more bold action to reduce our greenhouse reduction or to reduce greenhouse reductions. And it's going to release a draft of this on June 10th. And Ka'akua says that if everyone buys into this strategy, which involves developing public transportation options, more electrification, and big investments into the restoration of forests and wetlands that can act as carbon sinks, we can get zero emissions in transportation by 2045. So we can meet that bid deadline to eliminate emissions in our transportation system in the next two decades. But even with all of that action, we're not going to make that 2030 goal. Ka'akua says the problem is mainly pollution from air travel.
Really, that's because the high impact strategy to reduce emissions in aviation is adoption of sustainable aviation fuel. We would love to have electric jets that can take us to, you know, visit family in California and whatnot, but that technology is just not there yet. And so we really do have to look at cleaner fuel sources and increasing our percentage use of sustainable aviation every year. And so that fuel source, you know, we're having to import, obviously, our fuels, and the fuel is more expensive. And so there's planned to be a ramp up for sustainable aviation fuel, but we're not predicting hitting that 2030 goal for aviation.
You know, we've heard a lot of talk about innovation, right? I mean, we do have airline companies that are looking at battery-operated small planes, right, for inter-island travel. But, yeah, we're really reliant on that private sector to come up with these, innovative technological advances.
Yeah, and that was something that Kaʻokua really emphasized in the development of this plan, is that it's an all-hands-on-deck situation. So it will involve recommendations not just for the Department of Transportation, but other state agencies, the private industry stakeholders, as well as the public. You know, if they build a big public transportation system, folks need to choose to use that rather than continue to drive in single passenger vehicles. And the reason why the department is really delving into this strategy, they didn't just arbitrarily say, okay, now is the time that we want to address this. This strategy is one of the requirements of a landmark settlement agreement that listeners may remember that the state reached with a group of youth plaintiffs last summer who claimed the state hadn't done enough to reduce climate pollution from the transportation sector. And so some of those plaintiffs are actually now involved in the development of this Department of Transportation greenhouse gas reduction plan.
And so the fact that it looks like the state's going to miss the 2030 target, was that an issue for the settlement?
That was one of my questions, too. And Kaʻokua says no.
What we're required to do is take all actions possible, really. I think everyone wants to make sure that we, as a state and as a Department of Transportation, are doing everything in our power to get as close as possible, to meet or get as close as possible to those state target. So the focus is really like, okay, we have to start somewhere, right? We have to get as close as we can.
Yeah, interesting.
And so folks will be able to look through this plan themselves on June 10th. It'll be available for public comment for a month, and then a final strategy will be released in August. And some of the things that Kaʻokua says we might see in there is a pretty substantive legislative package that the Department of Transportation can take to lawmakers and say, hey, these are the things that we need to encourage the industry to develop more sustainable aviation fuel, for instance. It also, one of the things that they say that they've really tried to do in developing this strategy is balance the state's need to reduce carbon emissions in order to meet its goals and affordability, because transportation, everything in Hawaii is so expensive, right? And some folks don't have the opportunity to make a lot of choices that would reduce their own carbon emissions, like buying an electric vehicle. So their thinking is, okay, how can we create a multimodal system that serves all different types of residents in Hawaii, that ensures that folks have the opportunities, no matter where they are, no matter what community they're a part of, to get on board with this strategy. And that idea was one that was really important, Kaʻokua said, to the young plaintiffs who were involved in that original lawsuit. So we should, on the heels of this report that comes out, see more language about what a multimodal system would look like, public transportation options countywide, for folks to have options other than just passenger vehicles.
Well, we have seen, the counties make, you know, an effort to electrify their bus fleets, right? I mean, that's a big deal. But there's a lot, you know, out there, you know, that is being talked about. I mean, there was discussions about, you know, hydrogen power and maybe, you know, aviation fuel, you know, by getting the hydrogen from seawater, you know, just big picture ideas, but you really have to push the envelope in order to make things happen. And things don't necessarily happen very fast.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see the specifics of that plan. And remember, transportation is anything that travels on the ground, in the air, or across water. So it's a huge, huge swath of our economy.
Yeah. And the climate, though, in D.C. is not, is basically taking a few steps back, even though the state's plan is pretty clear. But those incentives to get people to, drive electric cars and that kind of thing, that's, been set back.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we'll see how things go. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HBR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her coverage on our website later today. It was a book that was first published nationally on Election Day. It wasn't planned that way, but that was how the stars aligned. And the audiobook version, which was produced here locally, was just released following intense reflection of President Donald Trump's first 100 days in office. The book's title is When No Thing Works, a Zen and Indigenous Perspective on Resilience and Leadership in the Time-Space of Collapse. We recently sat down with author and Zen master Norma Wong.
You know, my assessment of what's been happening over the last few years is that it's been increasingly more difficult for things to become resolved or for problems to be dealt with or institutions to be able to work. And that would have been the case irrespective of what the outcome of the election was. It just turns out that the results and everything that's happened since then, the last 16 weeks or so, has punctuated this notion of a country and really the world at being at such polarized odds with each other that we really are incapable of coming to the types of big decisions that we ought to. And so, therefore, we fight.
Well, you know, when you think about the turmoil and people are starting to wonder, well, who are our allies and who are our enemies? You really need to center yourself and calm yourself down when there is so much chaos. I think of the president's inauguration day and at the service, the spiritual leader that was there presiding had asked for mercy. Then when you see just what has happened, since then, that people need something. People need help in navigating through this time.
I think that we're in a really tight spot. And so many peoples feel the world as a threatening thing right now. And when that happens, there is one instinct and one of, among many, but one of the instincts that we have is an instinct to take care of ourselves only rather than the notion that we're all in it together. I think that growing up in Hawaii, that this is a place, the island mentality essentially, right, is that we may be of many peoples and we may have different interests. But when it comes down to it, we have to take care of each other because we are alone here, right, in the middle of the Pacific. But as it turns out, the world is in such turmoil right now that one of the instincts is that people are looking out for themselves rather than each other. And the individualistic nature of the United States doesn't help that very much. So here we are, and we're in a tight binary where, the success of any given moment is counted in small numbers of votes or small numbers of people speaking up in a particular way or small numbers of wins that quickly disappear. And the whole notion of this book is we cannot continue in this way. Not only the world's counting on it, our descendants are counting on us not continuing in this way.
In your book, you talk about the lens that people have to view the world.
A lens is something that we see the world through because of how we were brought up or the cultures that we are a part of, the things that have happened in the world while we were in it. So, you know, the babies that were born during the pandemic, for example, will grow up to see the world differently. Or particularly the teenagers during the pandemic will end up seeing the world differently, right? So there's this part where we are colored by our lens, and we need to understand that other people have different lenses in which they see the world, and not just fight all of our fights right through that lens. You know, I would say that a perspective that I was positing in the book is that there are peoples and places, like Hawaii, where because we have the gift of many lenses, because there are many peoples who live in close quarters with each other, who come from different backgrounds, that we see the world in a more complex way than might occur in other places. Not quite as black and white, you or me, you know, all or nothing. We seek a different way of resolution of things. And that would be something that we think of as island way, but I also think of that as being very, very indigenous in its perspective. You know, all indigenous peoples, wherever it is they may live in the world, right, would have this notion that people have to be able to be in relationship with each other to take care of the many needs of the peoples. It's a more collective notion. And then from a Zen perspective, that you don't live in the world alone. Among other things, humans aren't the only beings. And so, you know, therefore, a more interdependent way of being is something that we badly need.
So it's the Zen lens.
You could say that.
Growing up and living here in Hawaii, you know, you don't think of diversity and inclusiveness as a program. We
That's
just
correct.
Kind of live it.
That's correct. And I think that therein lies the strength of it, if it's not a program. When it's a program and it's prescribed and people feel like they have to behave a particular way because of rules, those rules could be something they either embrace or they could rebel against. And right now, we're in definitely a rebel against particular place. And it comes from scarcity. It comes from the notion that somehow some people's success will come at the expense of other people's, rather than this notion that we need to have the contributions of many people's in order to figure things out, right? Many peoples have something to offer, not only the labors, but the wisdom and the knowledge of many peoples. And this is something that is sadly at a de minimis in this country right now, you know, the country called the United States. I'd say that there's a lot of rebooting that will have to occur if we are going to see it to the other side.
Getting back to your title, it's When No Thing Works. Why is it that versus when nothing works?
Because I don't think it's true that nothing is working. I think that every day people still wake up that they have family, that they love each other. I think that some phenomenal things are still occurring in the world. So I don't think it's true that nothing is working. But the constructs of things, government isn't working right now. Government is struggling. Even in places where we have good-hearted leadership, that all of the institutions, the containers that we built, are struggling mightily. Even in places where we have good-hearted leadership, values-led leadership, the institutions of places are struggling to keep up with the many needs. The world right now is struggling. The world in terms of the climate changes that are occurring, you know, these vast differences that are occurring with respect to the weather means that there are places where people can no longer live. And so out of desperation, they migrate. And the migration is occurring beyond the capacity of all of the constructs of institutions that were built to manage those types of things, right? So human behaviors are overflowing, and all the things that we built in order to manage human behaviors are having a hard time. So that's what I meant when I said no thing. The things are not working.
And so what do you hope that people will get out of this book? Because we are in a time of just extreme disruption, and many of the institutions that, we could hold on to are cracking, or at least there is not as much trust maybe in those institutions. And, I don't know. But what do you hope that people will take away from this book?
Because of the extraordinary crisis that is occurring everywhere, within that is the opportunity for really big shifts to occur. Right? So it's only in crisis do things get dire enough that we're jarred away from our sense of stability and we move towards bigger changes, as in how we might treat each other, what it is that we may need to do for the future so that we actually have a place for our descendants. I would hope that they adopt a longer view than the short views of changes that we're looking at today. So it's like an indigenous perspective, a Kanaka perspective, is that you are doing the work in this time for many generations to come. And in the many generations ahead, everything is less tight, right? It's more possible. Bigger things can be taken care of. In the moment, we could argue about something like food security, and we can argue about the policies of that, or X, Y, or Z. Or we could say, you know what, Hawaii may soon, as in within a few decades, be in a situation where we're going to have much more sustainability than we have now. So let's just go about doing the really big things, not the small manini things, that would make sure that we're growing enough food for each other, that we are managing our waste differently, that we are in many, many hundreds and thousands of small enterprises, not dependent on a few large enterprises that would be more dependent upon what happens globally. And not as a way of isolating ourselves from the world, but understanding that all places are probably going to need to do this, become more interdependent on a small scale, and then in relationship with other places, and to cause a wider web of understanding and of a new kind of economy. So these big shifts, I think, are more difficult when there isn't chaos. That's a paradox. But when things are chaotic, as they are right now, well, why not? Why not? If you're going to take a gamble, do you take a gamble on passing a new policy, or do you take a gamble on planting our own food? I take the gamble on planting our own food.
I'm a big fan of resilience. And if there's anything that, I can pass on to my grandchild, I hope it's that concept of being resilient.
Yes, Lili'uokalani's version of resilience is the one that I hope we remember and that we adopt, right? Which is, she was a leader during a really hard time. And her notion is that if her people, if our ancestors didn't work for our own thriving, then it wouldn't matter if someday we got back our governance. So, we would have to, how would we know what thriving would look like? That we could take care of each other, could feed each other, that we could sing, that we would remember the stories, that we could have enough happiness within us, that we would bring children into the world and that we would care for them. And this notion that thriving, which is different than just a resilience of survival, it's the way that you win against those who would hope that you are no longer here.
Well, Norma Wong, thank you so much for taking time out and writing a book that we probably need now more than ever. But thanks again.
Thank you so much.
That was Zen master and author Norma Wong, who sat down with us this week for a very thoughtful conversation about her new book, When No Thing Works. It's available locally at Native Books at Arts and Letters or online, and just this month became available as an audiobook. Thank you.
Tune into HPR2 on Monday at 8 p.m. as the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, under the direction of Dane Lam, presents Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1 in C major, featuring internationally acclaimed pianist Mahane Teave from Rapa Nui. We'll also hear Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 and Every Tree Speaks by Iman Habibi. That's Monday at 8 p.m. on HPR2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Consumers have developed a new appetite, it seems, for, well, not name brand.
They are a different product than they used to be, to the degree that we don't really call them generics anymore. The stores have started calling them private label.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the brave new world of grocery store generics. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Changes may be coming to Hanama Bay, and here to talk about the proposed tweaking it, one of Oahu's most popular tourist destinations is Honolulu Civil Beat senior reporter Matthew Leonard. Good morning, Matt.
Aloha, Catherine. How are you?
Good, good. So these changes to the reservation system, driven by the need for more money.
Right. So there's, looking at the spreadsheet, which was something that the budget committee of the city council was doing this week, there's declining revenues. I mean, we know this is an incredibly popular spot, but the books are showing, you know, declines in revenue through the concessions. It's not just the admission price for non-resident visitors, the $25 charge and the parking. There's other income that comes through, like snorkeling gear and that sort of stuff. But there's a kind of a decline in the revenue projected. And part of the balancing act is really that, you know, a beautiful natural asset like Hanauma Bay still needs a lot of maintenance. It has facilities that need to be, you know, maintained. And they really have been friends of Hanauma Bay, the nonprofit organization, have said, you know, really you're looking at about 15 years of non-investment by the city in Hanauma Bay. And they're hoping that a settlement agreement that was signed last May, about a year ago, that restored funds to the Hanauma Bay Preserve Fund are going to be able to now be used to actually get all the facilities up to scratch and then kind of chart a better direction for the management of the reserves going forward.
Yeah, so the physical plant of the area, the bathrooms, that kind of thing, I mean, they're on the decline.
Yeah, and they've got a kind of a shopping list. Last year, they spent about $500,000 to improve the parking lot there. And this year, they're looking at just under $2 million to look at essentially the visitor facilities. So the concession stands, the rockway, faux rock on the walkways and buildings, and improving the audiovisual equipment that everyone kind of experiences when they go there as part of the education program. So, but all of that is kind of playing catch up. And Lisa Bishop, the president of Friends of Hanauma Bay, says that they really need to do a much bigger look at the infrastructure needs, including things like one of the restroom facilities over at Witch's Brew needs to be repurposed or closed down because there's seawater that's leaking into the pipes, she says. So that's the kind of example of the bigger challenges that they're going to face. And all that comes with an increasing price tag, right? Maintenance, construction costs aren't going down, they're only going to go up. So Laura Thielen, the director of Parks and Recreation, is saying, you know, people want to preserve these, you know, special places, but that takes money, and we're going to need more money.
So talk about the changes to the reservation system that they're thinking about.
Right. So Laura, in the story we broke the story that the county is definitely going to proceed with a pilot where they're essentially going to pre-allocate 500 out of the 1,400 daily reservation tickets as a package with a transportation provider or tour operator. So those 500 tickets are essentially going to be pre-sold to a tour operator, which means that the income from those 500 ticket sales happens no matter what, whether the tour operator sells them on or not. But the bigger goal is that, say, a tour operator sells a package that includes transportation, a bento box, snorkeling gear, whatever, that the county will also get a percentage of that package price on top of the admission fee. So it's a way of kind of trying to insulate and getting more stability into the revenue stream for Hanauma Bay, and also thinking of some more innovative ways to kind of, I guess, you know, future-proof the income base for the park by doing this pre-selling, you know, pre-selling this package of tickets. Now, obviously, everyone is already thinking that means there are going to be fewer tickets online for individuals to non-residents to reserve, and that's absolutely true. That means that there'll be 900 tickets available online 2 days before your planned trip rather than 1,400. Okay, so that's something that people are, you know, will definitely be playing out during the course of this pilot program. There's no start date yet, but it's definitely going to happen. And then I know people are always concerned about access for locals and local residents. And one of the things in the story as well is that the department is definitely considering ways to get more Hawaii people and younger people into the reserve, perhaps by opening up the reserve on the days that it's not open to the public normally for things like summer fun, some structured camping things with Hawaii youth, and some other kind of things that benefit locals.
Yeah, well, that's an intriguing idea. But yeah, it just highlights the need to balance, you know, I guess the more of the commercialization and monetization with taking care of those resources. But yeah, fascinating. Yep. a story about that. But thank you so much, Matthew.
You're welcome, Catherine. Anytime.
That was Sybil Beat's Matthew Leonard. You can check out his story at sybilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today's backyard quiz focuses on odd jobs around town. We were inspired by a 2009 Honolulu Magazine article about the coolest jobs in Hawaii. The careers that made the list include a pro surfer, a submarine pilot, a fashion photographer, and a dolphin trainer. But we think we've even found a cooler job, one that just a handful of people get to do. Tracy Miyashiro is one of the special few that work in this profession. He got the job more than 35 years ago after serving in the U.S. Army, where he operated heavy equipment. This experience gave him a leg up on the competition since he encountered the weather conditions that he deals with on a daily basis. For today's quiz, can you tell us what Tracy Miyashiro does for work? One last hint, his commute is a 45-minute drive from Hilo that can make your head spin. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
We now go to this week's Mono Minute, made with recordings from the Makaule Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to Honolulu's official bird, the Manu'oku.
Mm-hmm. Manu Oku, also known as white terns or fairy terns, are a medium-sized native Hawaiian seabird that can also be found in many tropical and subtropical oceans throughout the world. They have black bills and their feathers are completely white, except for a black ring of feathers around their eyes, which makes their dark eyes look much bigger than they actually are. Like many other seabirds, they have long, narrow wings with pointed wingtips that allow them to effortlessly soar for hours or days over the ocean looking for food, which for them is primarily small fish and squid. Manu Oku translates to Bird of Ku, the god of war and prosperity in Hawaiian mythology. Seafarers and traditional Hawaiian navigators use Manu Oku as one of the best indicators of land, as these birds typically fly out to forage on the ocean in the early morning and return by nightfall. Manu Oku had become very rare by the middle of the last century in the main Hawaiian Islands, but their populations have grown from just over a few birds in the 1960s to about 2,500 today. These birds don't bother with building nests. They simply lay a single egg directly into the fork of a tree branch, and the chick hatches after about a month of incubation. This may be one reason Manu Oku are doing better than many other seabirds in Hawaii that nest on the ground, making them easy prey to cats, mongoose, and rats. Interestingly, they have a special fondness for Honolulu, and they're one of the only native Hawaiian birds that can commonly be found soaring, nesting, and vocalizing in and around that city. In 2007, they were even named the official bird of Honolulu. So if you live in Honolulu and hear this outside your window, there's a Manu Oku nearby. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, connecting the community with the Manu Oku through programs to promote awareness, appreciation, and conservation of the official bird of Honolulu. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
In his epic composition, The Lightbringer, Hawaii Symphony composer in residence Michael Thomas Fumai portrays an epic battle between good and evil. Tell me, what was the genesis of this piece, The Lightbringer?
Well, this is a piece that really starts with the title, The Lightbringer, and it has to do with the devil, an unsavory figure in Christianity. And it is something I was always very interested in because I was brought up Catholic and read Revelations and, you know, was kind of trying to picture the genesis of what would become the devil. And so I wanted to write music that really foretold this battle of the angels that we see in that chapter of the Bible. And that's what The Lightbringer is.
Stand firmly on the side of good by supporting 24 hours of classical music each and every day on HPR2. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org to donate.
Ever wish you could read other people's minds? If so, you're not alone. It is the superpower at the center of a Nene Award-nominated young adult novel called Clairvoyance. Got that? Clairvoyance. It's a play on the main character's name and her ability to peer inside the mind of the boys at school. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson recently sat down with the novel's author, Christiana Kahakavila, to talk about what the story has to say about learning to listen to yourself and others. She starts by explaining the mashup of words that make up the title.
Clara is the main character. She just started sixth grade, and her best friend she's on the outs with, his name is Leo, and she wishes that she could just know what boys were thinking. And so she ends up having Claire, wait for it, buoyance. She is clairvoyant for what boys are thinking, and it is going to help her navigate friendships and make some new ones.
Or so she thinks.
There, I know there are some missteps along the way.
Which seems to be what happens when people gain access to other individuals' internal thoughts in cinema and literature. It doesn't ever quite go as people plan. What do you think it is that's so tempting, let's say, about this superpower that's so irresistible for humans?
I think it's that we think if we only had all the information, then we'd know how to handle the problem. And maybe Clara, not unlike her author, thinks that if she could just have all the information, she could logic it out. Like, we can just think our way through it. But, you know, life is so much more complicated and humans are so much more complicated. And it's about feeling and it's about listening. It's hugely about listening and about connecting. So, yeah, it's about more than thinking.
Yeah, I had a note about listening, which I want to come back to. But the other thing that strikes me about the sort of desire to tap into other people's thoughts is some desire to control, some desire to have control, right? More control in our lives to maybe fix the past or shape the future.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we all wish we could probably control more than we can. But I think especially in middle school, you know, kids are coming out of elementary where maybe they're slightly more comfortable with parents controlling things. They're moving into a space where they want to be closer to the adult world. They want to have more control over their lives. I mean, so much of Clara figuring out her life is just dependent on if an adult can drive her somewhere. And and that sense of being out of control, I think, is real. It's just so real for kids that age.
Great point. As someone who spends a lot of time driving around a tween, looking at it from the other angle, I think that you're right. That sense of, I want to get from A to B, and even that can't happen without intervention. Yeah. So that sort of supercharges that desire to gain more control in your life.
Yeah. And in middle school, I like to joke, I'm the only person who had a good middle school experience. And even having a good one, I think that feeling of feeling like you're the only one. I'm the only one who did something ridiculous at lunch. I'm the only one who's having problems with my friends. And that can feel out of control too. So one of the big parts of the story is Clara making new friends and reconnecting with the different kid characters in the book, understanding they're not alone and what they're going through.
You mentioned listening, and I'm glad you did, because that did really stand out to me as perhaps even a central theme of the book. In a lot of ways, I felt like it was a book about listening, who we listen to, how do we listen to others, how do we listen to ourselves. It seems like a good thing to explore in a world that's increasingly noisy, with everyone just sort of shouting across social media. And middle school is often a time when kids wrestle with, or parents, we should say, wrestle with the opportunity to enter the social media world. Talk a little bit more about listening and why it's so important to the book.
Yes, I think, well, so Clara's best friend's name is Leo, which is short for Kaleo, the voice, and he happens to be a very talented singer. So there are these little hints in the book, characters' names and other moments, that this is a book about learning to speak, which Clara needs to do, but also, yes, learning to listen and really hear where other people are at and not make assumptions. You know, so much of the social media landscape is also making assumptions about people or wanting certain assumptions made. If we think about the photos we put on Instagram, wanting the assumption to be made that everything's fine. And getting behind that mask and really listening is, I think, is just an important and heartfelt thing we can do in life.
Yeah, I think assumptions are sort of, in some ways, feel like the antithesis of listening. And breaking past assumptions absolutely is at the heart of getting to what someone is trying to actually communicate to the world. Talk about the device for channeling the inner voice in the book. I think it's an interesting choice you made.
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, Clara can hear what boys are thinking. And then the trick to writing any story is also understanding what the limits are of it. So I wanted a device so she could begin this journey back to understanding, listening to, and connecting with her ex-best friend, Leo. But Claire's also in a hard spot with her dad. He's gotten a great job in Arizona. She thinks she wants to leave the islands. She's figuring out what home is. And at the same time, I wanted her gift to be sort of limited to just kids her age for a variety of reasons. So actually, she has to start to learn to listen to her dad and other adults without her gift. And so often, in I think the best kids book, the gift is a way of opening up some skill that we need in real life.
Yeah, that makes sense. You use Alolo Hawaii throughout the book. It certainly isn't composed entirely in Alolo Hawaii, but it plays a big part in the text. Talk about your approach there to making that a part of the reading experience.
Yes, so I use Alolo Hawaii, and I also use Moments of Pigeon. Both of those choices were important to me because that's what I heard growing up here, and it's what I hear now still. So it just felt part of, if I'm going to write Hawaii as I do, then I need to write its languages. Another part of it is that middle schoolers and late elementary, they're so brilliant, and they pick up on language. And when they're reading, they're learning new words in English. And they're actually incredibly savvy at picking up cues. So all the Olelo Hawaii I use has some cues around it as to what it probably means, but I don't use any translations. And I have to say, the amazing and beautiful fan letters I get, the kids have no problem, whether they live here in Hawaii or they live in Boston, they have no problem with the Olelo or the pidgin. And I think it actually speaks to what flexible minds they have.
And it's a good way to create active readers, right? To engage the text and be more active in that experience of reading the book.
Yes, exactly. And I laugh at myself. I use the word cacophony at one point, which I feel is an absurdly large word. But again, I kind of like build out some hints as to what it probably means. And yeah, the young readers are picking up English as well.
Kids are good at guessing. They are. And I support cacophony there. That has sort of an onomatopoeic quality
to it.
You can catch the drift. Yeah. You mentioned Clara's dad moving to Arizona and themes of questions about home and thinking about home. And I feel like geography is another thing that plays an important part in the story. Clara spent years moving around a military family. Her friend, Pua, that she makes, also grew up on the continent. Talk about how these split experiences on the continent and in Hawaii inform how these characters see the world.
Yes, so I grew up in California. I grew up in Long Beach, California. My dad's from Maui. I was fortunate to spend a ton of time on Maui growing up. But I've always felt, you know, I grew up in the diaspora. I wanted to come back, and it was also difficult to come back. There are financial reasons for that. There are reasons of just relationships and jobs and other things that happen for adults. And I wanted a book that would reflect that honestly, the desire to come home, but also the desire to leave, because something is probably actually going to be a little easier on the continent. So yeah, Pua's just moved back with her family from Seattle, and she's trying to figure out what it means to be here. And then, at least for a good portion of the book, Clara is really desperate to get off island. She thinks it's going to solve all her problems, and that's sort of her dream. And so figuring out what home is and who it is a big part of the journey.
What does she discover about those questions? What are some of the places she arrives at as she wrestles with those questions?
I think a big part is that, so she lives with her tutu up on North Shore, up on the hillside above the Pupukea foodland.
Nice.
And her tutu has lo'i. And so she's really understanding a relationship with place that's very specific and also very active. Like, she really knows what it means to Malama Aina. That is part of their daily life. So her relationships are not just with humans. They're with more than humans. And they're with the land, and they're with the lo'i. And so part of her journey is discovering, yeah, what it means to have these really active relationships and intimacies with place.
I also like that Clara and Pua have sort of these, not conflicting, but they're coming from very different angles that you described. And I think that that helps them sort of inform each other and help each other grow.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. And they're both understanding what place is in different ways. Pua's mom happens to be a scientist. So they're studying streams. They get a watershed or Ahupua'a project from one of their teachers. So we're seeing all the kids kind of navigate what place means and what we can learn from it.
One thing that caught my eye is that you more or less begin the book with a mention of Iza's cover of Country Road, and you end there as well. Any significance there or any point of origin there in terms of how that song came to play a prominent role in the book?
It's a song I've always loved, so that was point one.
Good point.
Yeah. It's also a song that names places, which I think is important because the places here are very specific in their name. And then, yeah, it names Mount Ka'ala, and that has a role in the book. So I played that song nonstop while I was drafting the book.
So that's the title track for the soundtrack for the book.
It is.
Did your own process of moving back to Hawaii, as you've detailed, is very difficult in many ways. Did that personal experience inform how you were thinking about these themes of home and geography and belonging?
It definitely did. I moved back as an adult in, I have to think, 2007. And I have been off and on island since then. And then I had a job in Washington State starting in 2012. So when I got the offer from UH Manoa to come here in 2020, it really did feel life-changing. It was something I had wanted to do, my spouse and I were committed to doing, and Yeah. So I do have like a lot of the feelings that the kids have of what does it mean to move off island? What opportunities might be there? What jobs? But also what kind of commitments do you make to this place and in your family and your ohana and in the people who make this place yours?
Yeah, one can think about returning home in big, grandiose ways, right, in terms of identity and belonging and big words like that. But as you just detailed, it often boils down to pragmatics, right? Logistics, job, housing, these day-to-day realities.
Yes, and I think a lot about how Kanaka Maoli are the largest population who move off island, and they do so, you know, sometimes with heartbreaking reasons and sometimes with logistically smart reasons. But to be able to come home was one of my biggest goals. And I think it's something it just means a lot to me. And so I wanted my young characters to be able to do that. And then again, also like there's a point when Clara decides she does want to be here and she wants to stay with her tutu, like she has to have that talk with her dad. And of course, kids aren't always in control of these decisions, but I think being able to at least imagine a situation where a child can express what she feels and have this deep conversation with the parent she trusts most felt like something I wanted to put into the world.
Thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
Thanks. Thanks so much, DW.
And that was HBR's DW Gibson and novelist Christiana Kahakavila about her latest book, Clairvoyance. It was nominated for a Nene Award. Kahakavila will be appearing at the Atherton Studio tomorrow night alongside Megan Kamale Kakimoto as part of HPR's author series. Check out details on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Now it's time to plow our way to the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we introduced you to some of the many odd jobs you can find in Hawaii. Beekeeping, skydiving instructor, and brewer are just a few examples. But earlier, we introduced you to Tracy Miyashiro, who's held a particular odd job since 1985. We asked you to tell us what Tracy Miyashiro does for work. Take a listen to this 2022 Hawaii News Now interview with Miyashiro that gives his job away. He's talking about some new upgrades at work.
It made our job a lot easier because now we have two blowers instead of one. It cuts down the amount of time that it takes us to remove the snow.
Yep, Miyashiro has worked for 40 years as a Mauna Kea snowman in charge of clearing snow from the road at the tallest mountain on Earth, measured from base to peak. And congrats to Jeff Hahn from Hilo. He got the answer right. He shares that he knows Tracy, our snowplow. That's our quiz for today. If you have an idea to share, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to hear from Governor Josh Green about the Army leases that are soon to expire on the Big Island as well as here on Oahu. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Look for the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.